Welcome to Latte with a Lawyer, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the stories of some of America's most successful lawyers, figuring out what makes them tick, how they creatively solve problems, and how others aspiring to be them can follow in their footsteps.
Okay, folks, welcome to another episode of Latte with a Lawyer. I'm your host, Jonathan Brickman. And I guess it just turned this afternoon. We have Andrew Watto from the law firm of McKeldrew Portell. Nice to have you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Good. I guess we just turned the corner here. So coffee, latte with a lawyer, what's your morning beverage to get started every day?
So it's coffee, it's water. It alternates. I do always try to have water before I have coffee, but I have four young children. So some mornings I go straight to coffee.
Do you really? Four kids? Holy heck.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And your hair's still gray and you got it. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, for now. I mean, I'm blessed with that. Doesn't mean that there's not, it's not a lot, but yeah, I actually, because of that, I actually grind, it's my time in the morning. So I have a small hand burr grinder. lucky enough to have some friends in the coffee industry who provide me with beans. So I, hand grind and do a Chemex pour over pretty much every morning. So
nice. Yeah. Fancy. Okay. Good stuff. It's funny. I actually switched to already ground stuff because for some reason it kept getting stuck in my filter when I grind it at home for some reason. So I just went back to just buying already ground up fine.
It's just something for me to do. It's like, 5 or 10 minutes to myself in the morning. I have an electric kettle, so I just boil the water, which is quick. I just takes me a couple minutes to grind and then just kind of sit there and wait for it. Maybe at some point I'll get tired of it, but I've been doing it for like 2 or 3 years and it's a nice,
everybody needs a routine to get started, right? Get your head on straight to go after the day, right? And you got four kids.
Yeah, that's my early morning before everyone gets up. So just part of the day. So
yeah. What time you get started in the morning? Early?
Yeah, it's normally before 6. Got to get the kids up for school at around 6:30. So it depends on how busy things are and if I need to actually get something done. But yeah, normally between 5:30 and 6.
Got it. And you guys are all back in the office, or you work remotely?
So we can be back in the office. Our firm's kind of very flexible. So I could go into the office every day if I wanted to. I could never go in. So I kind of do a hybrid. I'm in between, probably average about 2 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where's your office? In Center City?
Yeah, we're in Center City. Just right block or two from City Hall.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I know Philly pretty well. My son was going to Drexel University, so I spent a lot of time in Philly.
Okay, yeah, that's where I went to law school. So,
oh, you did? Nice.
I went to Temple undergrad and then Drexel. So I've been in the city. I grew up in the suburbs, but I've lived in the city since I was 18, pretty much. So, and I still live in the city, just not in Center City, just in a section near Chestnut Hill, if you know where that is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Very nice. Excellent. Good. So tell me about the kind of law that you practice.
So right now, I am doing nursing home plaintiffs litigation. So my career started off on the defense side.
I saw that.
I had worked. I played Division I soccer at Temple when I was in college and got a job at an insurance company when I left. So when I decided to go to law school, at that time, it wasn't the easiest to get a job. And my background kind of led me to a defense firm where I didn't do nursing home work at first, just kind of general insurance defense litigation.
Yeah.
Then I worked at Buchanan Ingersoll in Philadelphia and did a lot of nursing home defense work there for about 7 years. And, liked the work, but didn't necessarily like being on that side of it. Having a bunch of kids and, you know, trying to find the right time to switch, took a little bit of time, but I finally found a place where I could switch over and do plaintiff's work. So I've been doing that for about 3 years and, you know, haven't regretted switching sides for one second.
Got it. Well, you're an athlete, so you probably like being on offense, right?
Yeah, it's, and also it's just, there's just, you know, there's a lot of, especially in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of this out there. And there's, as far as abuse and neglect and, you know, helping people that we can. And, you know, not everyone knows how to litigate these cases. So, being someone that does know how to litigate it, our firm, you know, tries to, you know, help people when we can litigate it, but then also, you know, guide them if we don't think it's necessarily a litigation case, you know, kind of guide them in the right way to, you know, because everyone wants to prevent whatever happened to their loved one from happening to someone else. So
yeah, for sure.
There are mechanisms to do that as well. So,
yeah. So what are the issues around that you litigate?
The biggest thing is, there's a few different type of injuries, but they all kind of go back to the fact that a lot of the places that are for profit and even ones that are, you know, technically not for profit,
yeah,
are the focus is to the bottom line, right? And patient care is directly related to staffing. The quality of care is directly related to staffing and injuries and that sort of thing. So it's pretty much undisputed that if you increase the number of caregivers and the hours of caregivers, that it's going to increase the quality of care. So, but at the end of the day, these places are fueled by making money. So, and in order to train and staff appropriately, you have to expend money. You know, payroll is obviously the biggest overhead. So the genesis of all these injuries are the lack or the deficient practice by the for-profit and the ownership of putting their staff in a position where they're not able to properly care for residents, and falls and fractures, falls and brain bleeds, infection, bed sores, all sort, assaults, sexual assaults, the gamut. I mean, choking, aspiration. There's a lot of unfortunate events that can occur when, the standard of care is not met.
And what are the claims in those cases? Or are there punitive damages, non-economic damages as well that you able to?
Yeah, we are. Pennsylvania has pretty clear case law concerning punitive damages. There's two claims. We have, your standard medical professional negligence claim, and then there's a corporate or a direct negligence claim that has been established by case law. And it was a case that, so we have the ability to prove direct negligence against the facility or the management company, as well as vicarious liability through, the care of the caregivers. And then the punitive damages are at play as well. And the understaffing and the survey history are major factors that the courts have instructed that can guide whether punitive damages are, should be awarded.
And are there caps in the state of Pennsylvania?
There's no damages caps except for punitive damages. I think it's 10 times compensatory damages. Right. So we don't have a, like other states, we don't have damages caps. So to get punitives, your compensatories are commiserate to that. So there is a, there's a ceiling based on your compensatory damages.
Okay, got it. Very good. Is it because of your work on the defense side that you went into this type of litigation, or is this just something where you felt a passion towards?
It's both, they just kind of merge. I had done this work for and, you know, knew it well and felt that, you know, I've done other sort of personal injury litigation, and felt it was something that, you know, I was good at. And then also being, you know, being able to help people as opposed to try to prevent giving them money and, you know, or trying to mitigate the amount of money that they're given. You know, obviously that didn't always feel good, especially, you know, on the defense side, you know, the majority of the facts that, and you sometimes resolve cases because you don't want the other side to know those facts. So, you know, being on this side, you know, I'm able to choose clients, you know, people that, you know, have real claims and that are, you know, looking to find out what happened or hold someone accountable. And, you know, we don't take every case. Being on this side, I'm able to choose the clients that I'm willing to go to battle for. Whereas on the defense side, you know, there's a partner or the firm had an insurance company that was a client and you're just given the facility, good or bad. So, you know, if the, you know, I'm able to choose, having that sort of discretion to choose the client that you're going to, so to speak, go to battle for is, and being on this side is just, it's a better feeling at the end of the day.
Oh, good. And is that what you're focused on exclusively? Or do you do other types of PI work?
So our firm does other sorts of PI work. We have a national civil rights practice. So, you know, like the George Floyd sort of thing, you know, our firm represents Ahmaud Arbery's family and some other like families across the country with police, you know, where someone was killed by the police, catastrophic, you know, all the major silos, catastrophic injury, trucking, medical malpractice. And the one thing we do that not a lot of places do is there's railroad work, FELA. And we do a lot of that, where we sue SEPTA and the local, railroad operators. For negligence, because you can sue them for negligence as opposed to workers' compensation.
Okay, interesting. So how did you, I mean, just go back a little bit. I mean, how'd you make the decision to become a lawyer, right? You were a soccer player, how'd you make that decision? Tell me about that.
Sure. I mean, you know, some of it is like cliche. When you're younger, people say, oh, you talk a lot, you ask a lot of questions, you know. So I think there was a little bit of that naturally, you know, in me. I was interested in things. I was interested in the law, and I wasn't 100% sure what I was going to do. I worked for this insurance company, and working for an insurance company, I worked with the lawyers that, you know, because I did litigation, and I worked with the lawyers, and that kind of cemented, like, I was on the claim side. And I saw what, you know, or thought I knew what the attorneys were doing on the other side. And that kind of cemented with me.
Oh, I see. That was your job after college? That was your job after graduate temple? Okay.
Yeah. So I worked. It was an auto insurance company. It was, you know, I lived not too far away from the office. I lived with some buddies in a town called Manayunk. And,
nice place. I've been to Manayunk.
Yeah. So, I just, dealing with attorneys every day, once I got promoted to that part after like a few months, I just, you know, it kind of cemented to me that I didn't want to be in claims. I wanted to go to law school. So, you know, being 24 or whatever I was, 25, I just started the process of studying, taking the bar prep or the prep courses for the LSATs, taking the LSATs, applying, you know, while I was working. And, you know, I knew I did not want to be in claims, and I liked this sort of stuff, but I wanted to be an attorney. So
you wanted to be an attorney. Yeah. Were you business?
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to, you know, study and work and take, you know, apply and do all that stuff.
Sure.
I think it's easier, you know, maybe if you're in college and you just kind of transition right from undergraduate. So,
did you go to school while you were working?
I didn't, but I guess to be clear, so I graduated in 2005, And then I started law school in 2008. So okay. I worked in between. But you know, to do well on the LSATs and to study and work and, you know, have a social life, it would have been, you know, easy to just say, all right, this isn't for me. This is too much. But,
But your experience helped you in law school, I'm sure.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. I think it's helped, you know, throughout my career, because when I was on the defense side, I'd been an adjuster, so I knew it was alike.
Yep.
And then, you know, now that I'm on the plaintiff side, I've been an adjuster, a defense attorney, and a plaintiff's attorney. So it gives me credibility, I think. It also gives me an understanding of, I can wear those hats and kind of know what each of those roles do, because in personal injury litigation, you're always having a defense counsel on the other side. And they also have, for the most part, have, you know, an adjuster client. I mean, sometimes they have, you know, a corporate attorney client, but I've worked with them as well. So it's been good. My background, I feel like, has helped me in my practice.
Very good. And do you get in the courtroom? Do you do jury trials?
Yeah. So I would say nursing home litigation, at least in Pennsylvania, there's not a ton of jury trials. We did a trial, my firm and one of my colleagues, Ian Norris, did a trial in September in Columbia County, Pennsylvania, right where Bloomsburg University, in a nursing home case. And we got a jury, we got an award. So, but not a lot of them, you know, not a lot of them go to trial. There's just a lot of settlements in those type of cases. So
are these big awards you're asking for? You got deep pockets you're going after, I assume.
Yeah. So Pennsylvania, we actually can't ask for a number. So, you know, in this case, that, you know, I guess maybe that's part of it on the defense side that they just, but that since we can't ask for a number, what do people think, you know, a fall on a hip fracture on an elderly person is worth? But in cases where there's punitive damages at play, I think that can increase the numbers. But that's part of, I think that's maybe part of the reason why a lot of them resolve. There's some uncertainty.
How do you maximize it then? If you can't suggest a number, how do you maximize the outcome for your client?
Yeah, well, so in the one thing, the one claim that we have in Pennsylvania, the corporate negligence, and what we also use to support our punitive claim is the understaffing, right? And what our experts show is the number, the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars that are saved by the corporation and the facility by understaffing the facility, which, you know, puts out kind of like a number out there for the jury, because you can't ask for a number, but we can tell the jury how much, you know, this company saved. They saved $3 million in the 2 years.
Oh, I see.
During this residency, you know, because there are no, you know, in other sort of injury cases in Pennsylvania, you can throw an economic number out there if someone has future medical or life care plan or something like that as, you know, a number. When the person's deceased and you're talking about survival action, wrongful death. I mean, bed sores are very horrific to look at if you've never seen them before. You know, so people that do this all the time, you know, they're maybe not as, I don't, you know, kind of look away like I maybe used to when I was a young associate, but a jury seeing a picture of a bed sore that's on someone's body that, you know, was not there when they were admitted and, you know, became infected and caused their death, I think will have significant value if in front of a jury.
Well, if you, you
know,
go
there's on, also
if
you... a lot of bad actors, you know, there's false documentation. There's just a lot of things that go on that can, you know, upset a jury.
Oh, sure. But if you're not going to trial most of the time and you go into settlement, I mean, how do you push for the biggest settlement? again, what kind of evidence do you bring, or do you prepare, you know, sort of a economic valuation for that discussion?
So the one thing is there's the major factor is the threat for punitive damages, because the case law, at least in our opinion, is pretty clear. There's minimum staffing levels. Yeah. And then there's also Department of Health surveys and the history. So, and there's also former employees that, you know, provide testimony. So if you're able to establish evidence that supports the potential for a punitive damages claim, that is what will significantly increase the value of the case.
Okay.
As well as, you know, showing that, because I think, yeah, as well as, you know, showing that someone's pain and suffering was real, right? I mean, that even though the person was 92 years old and they fell and broke their hip, doesn't mean that it wasn't painful and they didn't suffer for the last 6 months of their lives. So, but yeah, I mean, I think the major thing is supporting the potential for a punitive damages claim. Understaffing, failure to train, and survey history are major things.
And what do you use expert witnesses for that? Do you use focus groups? How do you make
your There's experts for the understaffing claim. As far as there's you know, as far as the economics, the financial aspect of it, you know, identifying and analyzing the data that's available out there from the nursing home that they submit to the government, that they provide in discovery, and, you know, that expert, you know, showing the numbers and how they were understaffed. And then there's also, you know, nursing home administrator experts that can link all that together between the understaffing and the failures and the injury that the resident suffered.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine, you know, privately owned, maybe they're less likely to do that versus like a Medicaid facility. But what do you find?
If they're privately owned, I guess it's the private pay facilities, right, where yeah. They can charge more money. But the majority of them get Medicare, Medicaid money. And, you know, it's a set amount, right? So it's not like they can.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They're only getting a certain amount of money that they're, as far as reimbursements. So, you know, they have to do fancy financial maneuvering to try to make their profit margin what it is. So, you know, there's stories across the country, and it happens in different states, and not every place does it, but, you know, they make money.
Yeah.
Private equity is in the nursing home industry, and they wouldn't be in there if they were not making money.
True.
So it's just a matter of finding, you know, where that money is. It's not, if you look at the facilities, it doesn't mean that if the facility is not making money, that the company's not making money. So it's just a matter of, you know, doing corporate discovery, trying to find out, you know, where the money is, if it is going somewhere, how much. And because the argument is they don't have enough money to provide more staff.
Yeah, I would think they would use a lot of technology. I mean, if you're going to cut back on labor, human capital, you better be using technology to help you, right? If there's to get alerted if there's a problem, or, you know, become more efficient in the operation. Do you see that happening in these facilities?
No, not really. I mean, I can't speak across the country, but not necessarily speaking. I mean, because they do have, you know, certain things. They do have technology for different things, like the call bell systems, right?
Yep.
Like, but the newer systems are more expensive, and you know, I don't really see facilities updating things like that. I'm sure they, you know, not to say that they don't they don't spend money and update things. It's just that we're not really seeing a whole bunch of tech utilization of technology that's directly affecting patient care.
Got it. Otherwise, you wouldn't have cases to try, I suppose, right? If they were doing a good job with that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's, you know, look, there's some people, you're going to have unhappy customers or you know, family and all sorts of things. But the sort of numbers we're seeing and the sort of things that we hear about, you know, CNAs don't get paid a significant amount of money, and they're the ones that provide the most hands-on care.
Yeah.
So they have a lot of CNAs, some LPNs, and not a whole lot of RNs. And there's high turnover. You know, you're kind of stuck based on your geographic location and the pool of available employees.
Right.
And how can people get there? You're not paying them a lot. And, you know, those are the people that are providing the most hands-on care.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've witnessed it with people in my own family. I've seen it firsthand. So I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think, and that's the thing. And that's another point about when you're talking about value. I think, you know, when you're talking about potential jerry pool, everyone, you know, has been touched by a nursing home in some case. And I would say, generally speaking, the perception that they have is, you know, not a positive one.
Right.
Doctors and hospitals, yeah. Nursing homes, you know, not as much. So.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's a bias there for sure, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're probably getting the award. How big do the awards get in these cases? I'm just curious. I mean, these $1 million, $2 million awards?
So the, I mean, they can be. It just kind of, there's, so from a settlement standpoint, you know, it's, there's, Pennsylvania has like two layers of coverage. There's a primary layer up to 500,000. And then after that, between 500 and a million, there's something called MCARE, which is like a state fund that healthcare providers pay into. And that state agency is the one that pays, you know, 500 to $1 million. And then okay. If there's excess, it's above that. But yeah, I mean, the potential value on a, you know, a nursing home case is, you know, can be into the seven figure value. It's not the majority of them, but, you know, depending on the circumstances and injuries, there's, you know, cases across the country that reach that. But I would say the majority of them resolve before an award and resolve in the six figure and with a six figure number for the most part.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. So let me, I'm just curious for the type of work that you're doing, what do you think the skill set is to be successful in your role?
So, I mean, I think the important thing is you have to know how this sort of industry works, as opposed to just being a med mal attorney, which is more focused on the medicine. Nursing homes are run and operate differently. And you need to have, you know, attention to detail, because you're going to be, there's a lot of different caregivers that provide care. And, you know, you just have to know, based on what happened in the case or what the allegations are, you know, who are the potential important witnesses, where is the potential important evidence, and kind of build that from the onset. If you don't, then it takes time to track people down. It takes time to do all these depositions, and that's really the best way to build these cases. So the other thing is, you know, you have to have a good kind of rapport and ability to communicate with your clients, because, you know, their expectations are sometimes, you know, because a loved one died and the allegation is it was someone's negligence that did that. You know, you have to be able to, you know, set your client's expectations on the front end, because, you know, they may think it's worth $50 million, and maybe to them it is, but
sure,
you know, in reality it's not. So, you know, and just to kind of adapt, because there, you know, there's a lot of the trial that we had in September. You know, I think we were successful because we were able to adapt on the fly. And that's probably true for all sort of litigators. But here, you know, there's theories, and we were able to adapt, I think, better than our opposition, and come up with a clear, concise, believable theory of the case. And, you know, just gave them a choice. Do you believe us or them? And, you know, they believed us. So, yeah, I mean, it's really important here to tell a story in the nursing home litigation. If you get too caught too much in the medicine, it takes away some of the impact that, you know, and the sympathy you can get from the jury when you're telling a story about what happened and how this person came in, was mistreated, and this bad outcome happened, as opposed to talking about their comorbidities and all that sort of stuff. Like, to just tell the story of, and, you know, you have your expert, they're going to have their expert, but to make, you know, to tell the story of what happened and not get caught too much in the medical aspect of what happened.
Got it. Excellent. Good. All right, good. Just to wrap it up here, what do you want to leave with the audience about your firm and the best way to connect with you? Just final thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if anyone has any questions about, you know, a loved one that was, you know, that something happened in a nursing home or assisted living facility or anything like that, you can reach out to me directly, you know, via email. And it may not be a lawsuit, but it may be some guidance on, you know, who the local agencies are you can contact to get some answers, because you're not going to get answers from them. And, you know, if anyone needs anything nationally in civil rights, like someone was harmed by a, you know, police officer or anything, you can reach out to me or my firm at our website. And yeah, I just want to thank you for this sort of opportunity. It's been great to kind of talk about this stuff, which is, you know, important to me, because it affects a lot of people out there, because there's a lot of people in nursing homes. And unfortunately, you know, things happen a lot, and, you know, it's important for people to know that there are people out there that they can help them. And, you know, even if it's not a lawsuit, there are other things they can do.
Excellent. Good stuff. All right. Well, listen, it was good to learn about this. I agree. You're doing good work. For everybody, again, Andrew Watteau, the law firm is McElderu and Portell in Pennsylvania, right? Just in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, our office is in Philadelphia, but like I said, we have a few national practices, and but yeah, we're just located in Philadelphia.
Good, excellent. And this is sponsored by Emotion Track, which is a legal tech platform, and we help litigators like yourself prepare for mediation and trial with our Insights platform. So thanks again, Andrew. Good to spend time with you.
Thank you.